Most Christians know that Jesus told us that all the Old Testament testifies of Him. The challenge we face is knowing how. How are the stories in Genesis about Jesus? How are we supposed to find Christ in the dark and bloody book of Judges, or the wisdom sayings of Proverbs? To answer all these questions and provide a guide for readers of the Old Testament who are looking for Jesus, I wrote The Christ Key. I'm Chad Bird, and for over three decades, I've been studying and teaching the Old Testament. I wrote The Christ Key for you, so you could unlock all the doors in the Old Testament, step inside, and say to each of them, "Show me Jesus." Visit ChristKeyBook.org to learn more.
Welcome to another episode of 30 Minutes in the New Testament. 30 Minutes in the New Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast and check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. And while you're over there, make sure you check out the events page because you want to come and hang out with us in Las Vegas, Nevada on October 16th and 17th. It's only $65 to come hang out with us, and it includes your lunch on that Saturday. All you people in the Southwest, get in your cars. Drive over to Las Vegas and hang out with Eric and me and a whole bunch of other people as we talk about assurance in Christ. We want to see you there. Also, make sure you check out the newly released book by our buddy Chad Bird, The Christ Key. Link is in the description. Or you can just go to Amazon, type in The Christ Key. It'll pop up. Make sure you get that, read that.
Not surprisingly, Dan, of course, the book is fantastic.
It's fantastic. It's doing great. You don't want to miss out. Make sure you grab that. You know, Chad's stuff is always good. All right, Eric, we are in Mark chapter 7.
We are.
Jesus has made the Pharisees and the scribes real upset by explaining to them exactly what defiles a person, and it's not not washing your hands. That ain't it. There's something going on the inside that defiles people. And he just sort of has left them with nothing to say, so he's going to leave there, go and say some other words that we find a little controversial to someone else.
Well, he's going to, not only is he going to do that, but he's going to go to a place that indeed the Pharisees and scribes would have deemed, of course, unclean, somewhere that they would not have wanted to go. We pick it up in verse 24 of chapter 7. It says, "And from there he arose and went away to the region of Tyre and Sidon." Now, before we go anywhere else and dig into this story, it's important to note that Tyre and Sidon was a well-known Hellenistic, in other words, Greek Gentile area. Jesus was sent, as he says many times, to only go to or to preach to the lost sheep of Israel, to save the lost sheep of Israel. But Jesus also is very aware of where his mission is eventually going to go. And this story, by him going to this place, is really a foreshadowing of that.
When Jesus says Israel, he doesn't mean the same thing that maybe other people mean when they say Israel. Jesus means the same thing by Israel that Paul means when he says Israel. This is kind of where Paul gets that from.
Yeah. It's this basically designation for the people of God, you know, mm-hmm. or people that God has granted faith to or whatnot.
Yep. Same sort of thing as when Jesus talks about his family, and it turns out that it's just those who believe.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And so continuing on, it says, "And he entered a house and did not want anyone to know." So again, you have this theme of Jesus trying to get away from people, yet he could not be hidden. So his fame is just spread too far that even in a predominantly Gentile area, people know that there's something special about him, that he can heal, that he's got a message unlike anybody else, and they want to be near him and hear what he has to say and receive the gifts that he has to give. But immediately a woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit heard of him and came and fell down at his feet. Now, the woman was a Gentile, a Syrophoenician by birth. This is very purposely pointed out. Again, this is about Jesus's mission, a foreshadowing that Jesus's mission to the world is for, indeed, the whole world. And she begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. And he said to her, "Let the children be fed first, for it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." Dan, that sounds a little insulting.
Yeah, there's some people that will try to soften this up. They will try to say that, oh, no, well, this word for dog here is not like the word that we would use for dog. It's about like a house dog, like a pet. Now, look, if you decide that you're going to call your wife a dog, but what you really meant to call her was a pet.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what kind of relationship you're in, Eric, but the difference between those things.
Let's just say that I wouldn't do that.
Yeah, the difference between me calling my wife a dog and my wife and me calling my wife a pet dog is exactly no difference in her mind.
Yes, that is correct. And so, you know, you're kind of left scratching your head at this point in the story. You're like, okay, so Jesus has gone to this area. He's healing and he's doing all sorts of things for people. And yet when she comes and pleads, and other gospel accounts tell us that, like, she's pretty insistent on it. Like, she's so insistent, in fact, that the disciples actually beg Jesus to send her away. That's what Matthew's account says. That this response from him is shocking, that he would seem to reject her.
It's actually meant to be insulting. That's the thing that you don't want to take away from it. You don't want to try to somehow make Jesus' words here unoffensive. They're supposed to be offensive. They mm-hmm. are offensive. Mm-hmm. And this was a common way for Jewish people to speak about Gentiles.
Yes.
They called them dogs
exactly
all the time.
That's exactly right.
All the way back into the Old Testament, you mm-hmm. see them refer to Gentile dogs. You see them talk about Philistine dogs and this kind of stuff. So
yeah, it still is the fact today that dog is used as an insult in the Middle East.
Mm-hmm.
That's still very much the case.
Yep. And so everything about this is offensive, and this woman could just get offended easily and just walk out, but that's not what she does.
Oh, sure. No, because she insists on her daughter being healed. And so she immediately answers him, "Yes, Lord, yet even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." And he said to her, "For this statement, you may go your way. The demon has left your daughter." And she went home and found the child lying in bed and the demon gone. So it's as if, Dan, like, there's this test of faith. You know, there's this test of her. Like, okay, you've asked me. I'm going to insult you. I want to see what you do with that. And she doesn't disagree with him. She accepts the title. She's like, okay, yeah, that's fine. I'm a dog. But even the dogs get the crumbs.
Yeah, so there's a couple of things here. There's a lot of things packed into this story. One, it shows you that part of coming to Jesus in faith requires that you get over the initial offense of being inferior to him. Jesus has called her a dog. This is only offensive if you think that you're something more than that in relation to God.
Yeah.
So she's not offended by it. And then she comes back with this great line that even the dogs eat the crumbs that fall from the master's table. The other thing about this is that, is this what Jesus thinks? Does Jesus think that she's a dog?
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about this a couple of times, and we do this whenever we're going through the Gospels, about how the ministry of Jesus is assuming sin all the time. So he's just taking the sins of the world as he's doing his ministry. And what he does here is he speaks the words that everyone else is thinking. So yep. The disciples don't want him to do this. They don't think he's going to do this. They're annoyed by this woman. Yep. All those around him believe that this woman is not who Jesus came for. This person is not of Israel. This is not your Messiah. He is not for you. Our Messiah is not coming for Gentile dogs. So what Jesus does is he puts all the sinful thoughts of those around him in his own mouth.
Yeah.
And then shows those around him something different, which is that even those who are not of Israel, as they understand it, can be part of Israel by faith. And yes. As he just got done showing you, that those who are part of Israel, as they understand it, are not part of Israel through their rejection of him.
That's exactly right. you know, Luther has it really preaches eloquently on this story. It's one of my favorite sermons of his. And I just want to quote a little bit of him, of what he has to say about this woman's response to Jesus. He says, quote, "Is not that a masterly stroke as a reply? She catches Christ with his own words. He compares her to a dog. She conceives it and asks nothing more than that he let her be a dog, and as he himself judged her to be. Where will Christ now take refuge? He is caught." You know, Dan, as an aside before I go on, it seems that only Luther can get away with talking like that.
Yeah.
catching Christ in his words. I mean, it almost seems a little irreverent, but listen to Luther's explanation. "Like when Jesus rebukes this poor woman, calling her a dog, when we feel in our conscience that God rebukes us as sinners and judges us unworthy of the kingdom of heaven, then we experience hell and we think we are lost forever. But that is just the time that we catch God in his own words. When we admit that, saying, 'Lord, it is true, I am a sinner and not worthy of your grace, but still you have promised sinners forgiveness and you have not come to call the righteous, but to save sinners,' then must God, according to his own judgment, have mercy upon us."
That's right.
End quote.
That's right. I mean, this is exactly what Jesus means to happen.
Yes.
I mean, God from the beginning has been always been willing to be trapped in his promises.
He calls upon his people to catch him in his promises.
Yeah. I mean, Moses does this when God's like, "I'm done with everyone. I'm going to destroy everyone and start all over with you, Moses, because these people are building calves and worshiping false gods. And it doesn't matter what I do or what miracles I perform. Their heart is far from me. I'm going to kill them all." And Moses is just like, "Well, you'd be a liar if you do that because you said you wouldn't."
It's true.
And then God doesn't do it. And yes. this is Moses catching God in his promises, saying like, "Well, you might want to do that, but you can't."
Yeah.
And this is exactly what happens here, where he calls her something and she turns turns his words around, and he says, "All right, I'm going to give you what you want. I'm going to give you those crumbs." And what do the crumbs result in? Exactly what she wants.
Yeah.
Her daughter healed. This is what she gets. I mean, and so, you know, sometimes you might go to the Lord's table and think, that's not very much Jesus' body and not very much Jesus' blood. I mean, that's just kind of looks like just a crumb. Yeah. That's enough.
That's enough, because those crumbs are what give you deliverance.
That's right.
So we continue on in verse 31. "Then he returned from the region of Tyre and went through Sidon to the Sea of Galilee in the region of the Decapolis. And they brought to him a man who was deaf and had a speech impediment, and they begged him to lay his hand on him. And taking him aside from the crowd privately, he put his fingers into his ears, and after spitting, touched his tongue. And looking up to heaven, he sighed and said to him, 'Ephphatha,' that is, 'be opened.' And his ears were opened, his tongue was released, and he spoke plainly. And Jesus charged them to tell no one, but the more he charged them, the more zealously they proclaimed it." Surprise, surprise. Yeah. This seems to be a common theme all throughout Mark's gospel. "And they were astonished beyond measure, saying, 'He has done all things well. He even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak.'" Now, Dan, the first thing that sticks out to me about this particular story that I think you and I have talked about quite a bit, because, you know, spoiler alert, we have a book coming out that is to some extent based on what happens in the story, is Jesus using stuff.
Yep.
Jesus using touch. In this case, doing something that even seems very, very weird, spitting.
Yeah, so, I mean, he has a guy who's deaf and has a speech impediment, and you would think that Jesus would be like, okay, I'll just heal him, and maybe he just touches him on the head or something like that. But he takes him from the crowd privately. He puts his fingers in his ears. Can you imagine? Sticks his fingers in his ears. And then after spitting, touches his tongue. Now, you have to assume that Jesus is not just spitting because he had to spit.
No, this is part of the process.
So he spits on his hand or spits in the dirt, and he uses that spittle,
mm-hmm.
and he puts it in his mouth.
Yes, that's exactly what it says, Dan.
So Jesus has got his fingers in this guy's ears, he's got his spit in his mouth, and he speaks this word, "Be opened." And what you have here is the word mixed with some means, attached to some means, some spit and some fingers in your ears. And what happens? The man can hear. The man can speak.
This is the way God most often works. God works through his word and various means.
Yeah.
He doesn't have to do it. I mean, this is the thing we emphasize all the time, Dan. Jesus doesn't have to do this. But I think the reason he does do this is because he continues to do this through his church today. Through the word and through various means, he delivers the gifts that we desperately need. Even means that look very, very unimpressive. I mean, in this case, nothing quite looks more unimpressive than spit.
Yeah, I mean, people be like, well, can God really do something crazy with just water and baptism? Can God really give you the forgiveness of sins through bread and wine that then he says are his body and blood? I mean, is that really possible? Well, Jesus can also heal you by spitting into your mouth and sticking his fingers in your ear. This is the kind of God he is. He does weird stuff like this.
Yes. I'm all about, Dan, like allowing the weirdness of the faith to shine. Like, I'm just fine with stories like this. In other words, there might be a tendency for some of us to want to smooth out the rough edges of things like this, whether it's this story or the one previous where Jesus calls a lady a dog. I mean, that's like, ooh, that's uncomfortable. But this is, he chooses to be earthy with the way he works.
Yeah, I mean, you could not like this God if you just like opened up, you know, Mark chapter 7, started reading, and you're like, I don't know, this God is calling women dogs and he's spitting in people's mouths. And I mean, I don't know what is going on with this. This isn't the Jesus that I learned about in Sunday school, but this is the Jesus of the Bible. And what happens at the end of him doing these sorts of things is people have this to say: he has done all things well.
Yes.
It's a great line.
Yeah, I mean, this is the kind of thing where people's minds are clearly, they must have been changed almost instantly, because you have to imagine as people saw him spitting that they're like, oh, what's happening here?
Yeah.
But then they see the results of a man who now hears, who has not been able to hear, and they go, hey, whatever his method is, we trust it.
Yeah. Yeah. All things he does well, even though all things he might not do the way you would do them.
That's right. That's right. So we enter into chapter 8 of Mark's gospel. It says, in those days, when again a great crowd had gathered and they had nothing to eat, he called his disciples to him and said to them, I have compassion on the crowd because they have been with me now 3 days and have nothing to eat. And if I send them away hungry to their homes, they will faint on the way. And some of them have come from far away.
Now, hold up. I feel like the disciples are undergoing a test here. Because what we have is a great crowd is gathered with nothing to eat. Now, this sounds like something we have heard very recently.
That's correct.
And Jesus calls his disciples over and says, I have compassion on the crowd because they have been with me for 3 days and have nothing to eat. Now, if you're the disciples, you would think, you'd be like, okay, like this is a test.
I know how this story ends.
Like, this is a test.
Yeah.
Probably what I shouldn't say is, how are we going to do it? Send them away to give good food. I probably shouldn't like do that sort of thing here, because like we just, not too long ago, he fed 5,000 people. Now, just so you know, this is going to be 4,000 people, less people. So they've seen Jesus feed more people than this.
Yes, with no resources or very little resources.
And so here he is. He says, if I send them away hungry to their homes, they will faint on the way. Not going to make it home. It's a long way home. Not going to send them there with nothing to eat. Some of them have come from a long way. All right. And the disciples answered him. Now, this is a big moment, because they really didn't answer it correctly last time. Now, certainly, these disciples who have seen with their own eyes all these things and have seen this exact scenario play out before, they're going to nail this one.
And the disciples answered him, how can one feed these people with bread here in this desolate place?
That is
womp womp.
Unbelievable and encouraging.
Well, it just shows you that, number one, it shows you the patience of Jesus with his disciples, whether it be them 2,000 years ago or us today. It's just an incredible amount of patience that he's like, okay, they still don't get it. Even though they have seen me do this, they still don't get it.
I mean, if there was ever a time in Jesus' ministry where there was an actual facepalm, though, it had to have been here.
I don't know. Yeah, it's either here or when Philip says, like, hey, show us the Father.
Yeah.
And Jesus is like, how long have I been with you? Have you not listened to anything I've said? But yes, definite facepalm moment. And so Jesus doesn't rebuke them. He's not angry with them. He just asks them, how many loaves do you have? This time they have 7. And he directed the crowd to sit down on the ground, and he took the 7 loaves, and having given thanks, he broke them and gave them to his disciples to set before the people, and they set them before the crowd, and they had a few small fish, and having blessed them, he said that these also should be set before them. And they ate and were satisfied, and they took up the broken pieces left over, 7 baskets full, and there were about 4,000 people, and he sent them away. And immediately he got into the boat with his disciples and went to the district of Dalmanutha. So this ends the way that you would expect it to end, Dan. Jesus, once again, takes very little and does a miraculous multiplication in order to keep the crowds fed and has enough left over to provide for him and his disciples.
Yeah.
It's exactly what you'd expect, and yet the disciples did not expect it.
Yeah, I mean, it's exactly what Jesus did before. And you know, a lot of it, the language is similar. What you got to love about this is that out of compassion for the people who are following him, Jesus refuses to send them away hungry. You know, he says that they're, you know, the disciples say, like, look, we can't feed people in this desolate place. We don't have anything to give them. And one of the beautiful things about this is that it shows you that Jesus is going to take care of you in desolate places. And I think that you can sort of look at this as you feel like you live in sort of a spiritually desolate place, right? As we contend with the flesh and sin and the devil and the world, Jesus still has provided a place to feed us, to take care of us in the midst of that desolate place. So when you go to church and you go to the Lord's table and God is feeding you that bread and that wine, that body and that blood, God is taking care of you in a desolate place, and he does it with very little, but it's more than enough.
Always. And then we come across this strange little passage, especially in light of all that we've just read. So, I mean, first you have Jesus healing this woman's daughter, and we're told that people go and spread the word about the next miracle, which is the man who's healed from deafness. And then you have Jesus providing food out with very little for thousands of people, right? Well, what comes next? Verse 11, the Pharisees came and began to argue with him, seeking from him a sign from heaven to test him.
That's
what?
Crazy.
So, you know, the disciples, you know, are slow to learn, but the Pharisees seem to just be completely blind to Jesus's power and abilities.
Pharisees come, they begin to argue with him, seeking from him a sign from heaven to test him. So they are having an argument with him about this. How about this? Jesus sighed deeply in his spirit.
In other words, exasperation.
Yeah.
It's like, come on.
Like, how many things does this guy have to do? They're like, do something miraculous. I mean, that is crazy.
Well, and it does give you an insight into Jesus is not going, he's not some like carnival sideshow.
No.
He's not going to give them a sign merely because they just want a sign. The signs that he does are for the benefit of people. They're always for the benefit of people, for the releasing of captives, for the setting free of those who are in bondage to their sin, or in bondage to illness, or whatever it might be. But he's not just going to do a sign. He's not some sort of carnival performer.
Right.
He's not a circus act. And so, indeed, he says, why does this generation seek a sign? Truly, I say to you, no sign will be given to this generation. When he's talking about this generation, I think we can safely say that that's not obviously meaning all people of that time, because he clearly has just done a bunch of signs, but he's speaking specifically to this group of people, this group of legalists, the Pharisees and the scribes, that demand he do a sign on cue so that, you know, he can perform them. He's, I'm not going to do it for you. No.
Yeah, and I think it's just that no sign will be given for the sake of giving a sign. He's not going to do that. So
yeah,
they're not. It's not like they brought someone to him who was in need. Oh, here's this blind man. Can you heal him? It wasn't like that. They were just like, perform a sign. Like, they wanted him to do something spectacular. They want to have him make something appear in the sky, or like, yeah, or whatever it is. They just wanted to see something miraculous without a need attached to it. Yeah. And no sign for the sake of a sign is going to be given that generation.
Yeah, or any generation. True. I mean, it is true. Paul says, you know, in 1 Corinthians 1, that the Jews demand signs, the Greeks demand wisdom, but we preach Christ crucified. And this is a moment at which Christ is basically saying, like, no, you can hear my word. My word is enough. I'm not just going to perform signs for the sake of performing signs for you. And so it says he left them, got into the boat again, and went to the other side. Now, they had forgotten to bring bread, and they had only one loaf with them in the boat. And he cautioned them, saying, watch out, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. And they began discussing with one another the fact that they had no bread.
Now, wait a second. A couple of things here. They forgot to bring bread, and they only have one loaf. Jesus says, thinking about this conversation that he just had with these Pharisees and how annoying that was, and he says, watch out, beware the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. So he's going to say, man, you're going to see a lot of things. Watch out that you don't start just wanting signs for the sake of signs. You're not wanting just signs and wonders because those are cool. And they begin discussing, ignoring that entirely.
Yes.
The fact that they had no bread. What are we going to do? We forgot the bread. How are we going to be taken care of when all we have is one loaf for the 12 of us? Pretty unbelievable.
Once again, very encouraging, Dan. It really doesn't take much to
show.
It
sounds
that,
like something I would do, Eric.
Yeah, but what about me now? What about me now? Yes. It's always the question of like, but I don't know how it's going to be taken care of today.
Jesus is like, you need to beware of the leaven of the Pharisees. I'm like, yeah. What about lunch, though?
And so Jesus, aware of this, said to them, why are you discussing the fact that you have no bread?
Yeah, this has got to be mind-blowing.
Do you not yet perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Having eyes, do you not see? And having ears, do you not hear? And do you not remember when I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you take up? They said to him, 12. And the 7 for the 4,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you take up? And they said to him, 7. And he said to them, do you not yet understand?
Yeah.
Do you get it now?
Yeah. So if you look at the way that Jesus constructs, it's like, with having eyes, do you not see? So did you not see what I just did twice? And having ears, did you not hear how the things I have told you? And and in your mind, do you not remember? And it basically says, stop worrying about bread. I think I've proven that I will take care of you.
Well, and this is, we'll get into this next week, but this is a great example of sort of Mark crafting a narrative, because it's not an accident that right after this, a blind man does see who Jesus really is and does understand what Jesus is capable of, seemingly more so than even his own disciples in this story that we just finished. And we'll get into that next week, but it's a really great example of how the narrative is crafted so that we can see what we should actually see in Jesus and not fall into the trap of the disciples.
Yeah. All right, Eric. Well, we will be back next week to talk about that.
All right. Sounds good.